Harvey and his team were MIT students, presumably able to knock off a few dozen lines of code before their morning coffee. Why not just write a program to run through all combinations of 300,000 windfall tickets to see which one provided the lowest variance strategy? That wouldn't be a hard program to write. The one small problem would be the way all matter and energy in the universe decayed into heat death by the time your program had handled the first tiny fragment of a microsliver of the data it was trying to analyze. From the point of view of a modern computer, 300,000 is not a very large number. But the objects that the proposed program has to pick through are not the 300,000 tickets, they are the possible sets of 300,000 tickets to be purchased from the 10 million possible cash windfall tickets. How many of those sets are there? More than 300,000. More than the number of subatomic particles that exist or have ever existed. A lot more. You've probably never even heard of a number as big as the number of ways to select your 300,000 tickets. What we're up against here is the dreaded phenomenon known by computer science types as the combinatorial explosion. Put simply, very simple operations can change manageably large numbers into absolutely impossible ones. If you want to know which of the 50 states is the most advantageous place to site your business, that's easy. You just have to compare 50 different things. But if you want to know which route through the 50 states is the most efficient, the so-called traveling salesman problem, the combinatorial explosion goes off and you face difficulty on a totally different scale. There are about 30 vigintillion routes to choose from. In more familiar terms, that's 30,000 trillion 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 trillion. Boom! So there'd better be another way to choose our lottery tickets to tamp down variance. Would you believe me if I told you it all came down to plane geometry? Where the train tracks meet. Parallel lines don't meet. That's what makes them parallel. But parallel lines sometimes appear to meet. Think of a pair of train tracks alone in an empty landscape, the two rails seeming to converge as your eyes follow them closer and closer to the horizon. I find it helps to have some country music playing if you want a really vivid mental image here. This is the phenomenon of perspective. When you try to depict the three-dimensional world on your two-dimensional field of vision, something has to give. The people who first figured out what was going on here were the people who needed to understand both how things are and how things look, and the difference between the two. Namely, painters. The moment, early in the Italian Renaissance, at which painters understood perspective, was the moment visual representation changed forever. The moment when European paintings stopped looking like your kid's drawings on the refrigerator door, if your kid mostly drew Jesus dead on the cross, and started looking like the things they were paintings of. Or at least they looked like certain kinds of optical representations of the things that they were paintings of, which, over the years, we've come to think of as realistic. What counts as realism has been the subject of hot contention among art critics for about as long as there's been art criticism. How exactly Florentine artists like Filippo Brunelleschi came to develop the modern theory of perspective has occasioned 100 quarrels among art historians into which we won't enter here. What we know for sure is that the breakthrough joined aesthetic concerns with new ideas for mathematics and optics. A central point was the understanding that the images we see are produced by rays of light that bounce off objects and subsequently strike our eye. This sounds obvious to a modern ear, but believe me, it wasn't obvious then. Many of the ancient scientists, most famously Plato, argued that vision must involve a kind of fire that emanated from the eye. This view goes at least as far back as Alcmaeon of Croton, one of the Pythagorean weirdos we met in Chapter 2. The eye must generate light, Alcmaeon argued. What other source could there be for the phosphine, the stars you see when you shut your eyes and press down on your eyeball? The theory of vision by reflected rays was worked out in great detail by the 11th century Cairene mathematician Abu Ali al-Hasan ibn al-Haytham, but let's call him al-Hazen as most Western writers do. His treatise on optics, the Kitab al-Manazir, was translated into Latin and taken up eagerly by philosophers and artists seeking a more systematic understanding of the relation between sight and the things seen. The main point is this. A point P on your canvas represents a line in three-dimensional space. Thanks to Euclid, we know there's a unique line containing any two specified points. In this case, the line is the one containing P and your eye. Any object in the world that lies on that line gets painted at point P. Now imagine you are Filippo Brunelleschi, standing out on the flat prairie, the canvas on an easel in front of you, painting the train tracks. Anachronistic, okay, but just go with it. The track consists of two rails, which we call R1 and R2. Each one of these rails, drawn on the canvas, is going to look like a line. And just as a point on the canvas corresponds to a line in space, a line on the canvas corresponds to a plane. The plane P1 corresponding to R1 is the one swept out by the lines joining each point on the rail to your eye. In other words, it's the unique plane containing both your eye and the rail R1. Similarly, the plane P2 corresponding to R2 is the one containing your eye and R2. Each of the two planes cuts the canvas in a line, and we call these lines L1 and L2. The two rails are parallel, but the two planes are not. How could they be? They meet at your eye, and parallel planes do not meet anywhere. But planes that aren't parallel have to intersect in a line. In this case, the line is horizontal, emanating from your eye and proceeding parallel to the train tracks. The line, being horizontal, does not meet the prairie. It shoots out toward the horizon, never touching the ground. But, and here is the point, it meets the canvas at some point V. Since V is on the plane R1, it must be on the line L1, where R1 cuts the canvas. And since V is also on R2, it must be on L2. In other words, V is the point on the canvas where the painted train tracks meet. In fact, any straight path on the prairie that runs parallel to the train tracks will look, on the canvas, like a line through V. V is the so-called vanishing point, the point through which the paintings of all lines parallel to the tracks must pass. In fact, every pair of parallel tracks determines some vanishing point on the canvas. Where the vanishing point is depends on which direction the parallel lines are going. The only exceptions are pairs of lines parallel to the canvas itself, like the slats between the rails. They'll still look parallel in your painting. The conceptual shift that Brunelleschi made here is the heart of what mathematicians call projective geometry. Instead of points in the landscape, we think of lines through our eye. At first glance, the distinction might seem purely semantic. Each point on the ground determines one and only one line between the point and our eye, so what does it matter whether we think about the point or think about the line? The difference is just this. There are more lines through our eye than there are points on the ground, because there are horizontal lines which don't intersect the ground at all. These correspond to the vanishing points on our canvas, the places where train tracks meet. You might think of this line as a point on the ground that is infinitely far away in the direction of the tracks, and indeed, mathematicians usually call them points at infinity. When you take the plane Euclid knew and glue on the points at infinity, you get the projective plane. Most of the projective plane looks just like the regular flat plane you're used to. But the projective plane has more points, those so-called points at infinity, one for each possible direction along which a line can be oriented in the plane. You should think of the point which corresponds to the vertical direction as being infinitely high up along the vertical axis, but also infinitely low down along the vertical axis. In the projective plane, the two ends of the y-axis meet at the point at infinity, and the axis is revealed to be not really a line, but a circle. If you travel infinitely far upwards until you arrive at the point at infinity, and then keep on going, you find yourself still traveling upwards, but now heading back toward the center from the bottom edge of the picture. This kind of leaving one way and coming back the other enthralled the young Winston Churchill, who recalled vividly the one mathematical epiphany of his life, writing, "I had a feeling once about mathematics, that I saw it all, depth beyond depth was revealed to me, the bis and the abyss. I saw, as one might see the transit of Venus, or even the Lord Mayor's show, a quantity passing through infinity and changing its sign from plus to minus. I saw exactly how it happened and why the tergiversation was inevitable, and how the one step involved all the others. It was like politics, but it was after dinner, and I let it go." In fact, this point at infinity is not just the endpoint of the y-axis, but of any vertical line. If two different lines are both vertical, they are parallel, and yet, in projective geometry, they meet at the point at infinity. David Foster Wallace was asked, in a 1996 interview, about the ending of Infinite Jest, which many people found abrupt. Did he, the interviewer asked, avoid writing an ending because he just got tired of writing it? Wallace replied, rather testily, There is an ending as far as I'm concerned. Certain kinds of parallel lines are supposed to start converging in such a way that an end can be projected by the reader somewhere beyond the right frame. If no such convergence or projection occurred to you, then the book's failed for you. The projective plane has the defect that it's kind of hard to draw, but the advantage that it makes the rules of geometry much more agreeable. In Euclid's plane, two different points determine a single line, and two different lines determine a single intersection point, unless they're parallel, in which case they don't meet at all. In mathematics, we like rules, and we don't like exceptions. In the projective plane, you don't have to make any exceptions to the rule that two lines meet at a point, because parallel lines meet too. Two points determine a single line, two lines meet at a single point. End of story. It's perfectly symmetrical and elegant in a way that classical plane geometry is not. And it's not coincidence that projective geometry arose naturally from attempts to solve the practical problem of depicting the three-dimensional world on a flat canvas. Mathematical elegance and practical utility are close companions, as the history of science has shown again and again. Sometimes scientists discover the theory and leave it to mathematicians to figure out why it's elegant, and other times mathematicians develop an elegant theory and leave it to scientists to figure out what it's good for. One thing the projective plane is good for is representational painting. Another is picking lottery numbers. A tiny geometry. The geometry of the projective plane is governed by two axioms. Every pair of points is contained in exactly one common line. Every pair of lines contains exactly one common point. Once mathematicians had found one kind of geometry that satisfied these two perfectly tuned axioms, it was natural to ask whether there were any more. It turns out there are a lot. Some are big, some are small. The very tiniest is called the Fano plane, after its creator, Gino Fano, who in the late 19th century was one of the first mathematicians to take seriously the idea of finite geometries. The Fano plane is a small geometry indeed, consisting of only 7 points. The 7 lines in this geometry are small too, possessing only 3 points each. And yet this so-called geometry, exotic as it is, satisfies axioms 1 and 2 just as well as Brunelleschi's plane did. Fano had an admirably modern approach. He had, to use Hardy's phrase, the habit of definition, avoiding the unanswerable question of what geometry really was, and asking instead which phenomena behave like geometry. In Fano's own words, as a basis for our study, we assume an arbitrary collection of entities of an arbitrary nature, entities which, for brevity, we shall call points, but this is quite independent of their nature. For Fano and his intellectual heirs, it doesn't matter whether a line looks like a line, a circle, a mallard duck, or anything else. All that matters is that lines obey the laws of lines set down by Euclid and his successors. If it walks like geometry and it quacks like geometry, we call it geometry. To one way of thinking, this move constitutes a rupture between mathematics and reality and is to be resisted. But that view is too conservative. The bold idea that we can think geometrically about systems that don't look like Euclidean space, and even call these systems geometries with head held high, turned out to be critical to understanding the geometry of the relativistic space-time we live in. And nowadays, we use generalized geometric ideas to map internet landscapes, which are even further removed from anything Euclid would recognize. That's part of the glory of math. We develop a body of ideas, and once they're correct, even when applied far, far outside the context in which they were first conceived. For example, you can label the points of Fano's plane by the numbers 1 through 7. And if we list the 7 lines, recording for each the set of 3 points that constitute it, we get 124, 135, 167, 257, 347, 236, and 456. This is none other than the 7-ticket combo we saw in the last section, the one that hits each pair of numbers exactly once, guaranteeing a minimum payoff. At the time, that property seemed impressive and mystical. How could anyone have come up with such a perfectly arranged set of tickets? But now, I've opened the box and revealed the trick. It's simple geometry. each pair of numbers appears on exactly one ticket because each pair of points appears on exactly one line. It's just Euclid, even though we're speaking now of points and lines Euclid would not have recognized as such. I'm sorry, did you say BOFOB? The Phonoplane tells you how to play the 7-number Transylvanian lottery without taking on any risk. But what about the Massachusetts lottery? There are lots of finite geometries with more than 7 points, but none, unfortunately, that precisely meet the requirements of cash windfall. Something more general is needed. The answer doesn't come directly from Renaissance painting or Euclidean geometry, but from another unlikely source, the theory of digital signal processing. Suppose I want to send an important message to a satellite, like, turn on right thruster. Satellites don't speak English, so what I'm actually sending is a sequence of ones and zeros, what computer scientists call bits. 1110101. This message seems crisp and unambiguous, but in real life, communication channels are noisy. Maybe a cosmic ray strikes the satellite just as it's receiving your transmission and garbles one bit of the message, so that the satellite receives 1010101. That message doesn't seem very different, but if the changing of the bit switches the instruction from right thruster to left thruster, the satellite might be in for serious trouble. Satellites are expensive, so this is trouble you really want to avoid. If you were trying to talk to a friend at a noisy party, you might have to repeat yourself to keep the noise from drowning out your message. The same trick works with the satellite. In our original message, we can repeat each bit twice, sending 00 instead of 0 and 11 instead of 1. 11111100110011. Now, when the cosmic ray strikes the second bit of the message, the satellite sees 10111100011. The satellite knows that each 2-bit segment is supposed to be either 00 or 11, so that initial 10 is a red flag. Something has gone wrong. But what? That's tough for the satellite to figure out. Since it doesn't know exactly where the noise corrupted the signal, there's no way to tell whether the original message started with 00 or 11. This problem, too, can be fixed. Just repeat 3 times instead of twice. 111, 111, 111, 000, 111, 000, 111. The message comes through corrupted like this. 101, 111, 111, 000, 111, 000, 111. But now the satellite is in good shape. That first 3-bit segment it knows is supposed to be 000 or 111, so the presence of 101 means something's gone awry. But if the original message was 000, 2 bits must have been corrupted in very close proximity, an unlikely event as long as the frequency of message-zapping cosmic rays is pretty small. So the satellite has good reason to let majority rule. If 2 out of the 3 bits are 1, the odds are very good that the original message was 111. What you've just witnessed is an example of an error-correcting code, a communications protocol that allows the receiver to cancel out the errors in a noisy signal. The idea, like basically everything else in information theory, comes from Claude Shannon's monumental 1948 paper, A Mathematical Theory of Communication. A Mathematical Theory of Communication. Doesn't that sound a little grandiose? Isn't communication a fundamentally human activity that can't be reduced to cold numbers and formulas? Understand this. I warmly endorse, in fact, highly recommend, a bristly skepticism in the face of all claims that such and such an entity can be explained or tamed or fully understood by mathematical means. And yet, the history of mathematics is a history of aggressive territorial expansion, as mathematical techniques get broader and richer, and mathematicians find ways to address questions previously thought of as outside their domain. A mathematical theory of probability sounds unexceptional now, but once it would have seemed a massive overreach. Math was about the certain and the true, not the random and the maybe-so. All that changed when Pascal, Bernoulli, and others found mathematical laws that governed the workings of chance. A mathematical theory of infinity? Before the work of Georg Cantor in the 19th century, the study of the infinite was as much theology as science. Now, we understand Cantor's theory of multiple infinities, each one infinitely larger than the last, well enough to teach it to first-year math majors. To be fair, it does kind of blow their minds. These mathematical formalisms don't capture every detail of the phenomena they describe and aren't intended to. There are questions about randomness, for instance, about which probability theory is silent. To some people, the questions that stay outside the reach of math are the most interesting ones. But to think carefully about chance nowadays without having probability theory somewhere in mind is a mistake. If you don't believe me, ask James Harvey, or better yet, ask the people whose money he won. Will there be a mathematical theory of consciousness? Of society? Of aesthetics? People are trying, that's for sure, with only limited success so far. You should distrust all such claims on instinct, but you should also keep in mind that they might end up getting some important things right. The error-correcting code does not at first seem like revolutionary mathematics. If you're at a noisy party, repeat yourself. Problem solved. But that solution has a cost. If you repeat every bit of your message three times, your message takes three times as long to transmit. That might not be a problem at a party, but it could be a problem if you need the satellite to turn on its right thruster right this second. Shannon, in the paper that launched the theory of information, identified the basic trade-off that engineers still grapple with today. The more resistant to noise you want your signal to be, the slower your bits are transmitted. The presence of noise places a cap on the length of a message your channel can reliably convey in a given amount of time. This limit was what Shannon called the capacity of the channel. Just as a pipe can only handle so much water, a channel can only handle so much information. But fixing errors doesn't require you to make your channel three times skinnier, as the repeat three times protocol does. You can do better. And Shannon knew this perfectly well because one of his colleagues at Bell Labs, Richard Hamming, had already figured out how. Hamming, a young veteran of the Manhattan Project, had low-priority access to Bell's 10-ton Model 5 mechanical relay computer. He was only allowed to run his programs on the weekends. The problem was that any mechanical error could halt his computation, with no one available to start the machine running again until Monday morning. This was annoying. An annoyance, as we know, is one of the great spurs to technical progress. Wouldn't it be better, Hamming thought, if the machine could correct its own errors and keep on plugging? And so he developed a plan. The input to the Model 5 can be thought of as a string of zeros and ones, just like the transmission to the satellite. The math doesn't care whether those digits are bits in a digital stream, the states of an electrical relay, or holes in a strip of tape, at the time a state-of-the-art data interface. Hamming's first step was to break the message up into blocks of three symbols. The Hamming code is a rule that transforms each of these three-digit blocks into a seven-digit string. The seven-bit blocks are called code words. The eight code words are the only blocks the code allows. If the receiver sees anything else coming over the wire, something has gone wrong for sure. Say you receive 1010001. You know this can't be right because 1010001 isn't a code word. What's more, the message you received differs in only one place from the code word 1110001. And there's no other code word that's so close to the messed up transmission you actually saw. So you can feel pretty safe in guessing that the code word your correspondent meant to send was 1110001. You might think we just got lucky. What if the mystery transmission had been close to two different code words? Then we wouldn't be able to make a confident judgment. But that can't happen, and here's why. Think again of the lines in the Fano plane. 124, 135, 167, 257, 347, 236, and 456. How would you describe this geometry to a computer? Computers like to be talked to in zeros and ones, so write each line as a string of zeros and ones, where a zero in place n stands for point n is on the line, and a one in place n means point n is not on the line. So that first line, 124, gets represented as 0010111, and the second line, 135, is 01010111. Both strings are code words in the Hamming code. In fact, the 7 non-zero code words in the Hamming code match up exactly to the 7 lines in the Fano plane. The Hamming code and the Fano plane, and for that matter, the optimal ticket combo for the Transylvanian lottery, are exactly the same mathematical object in two different outfits. This is the secret geometry of the Hamming code. A code word is a set of 3 points in the Fano plane that form a line. Flipping a bit in the string is the same thing as adding or deleting a point. So as long as the original code word wasn't a string of 7 zeros, the balanced transmission you get corresponds to a set with either 2 or 4 points. If you receive a 2-point set, you know how to figure out the missing point. It's just the 3rd point on the unique line that joins the 2 points you received. What if you receive a 4-point set of the form line plus 1 extra point? Then you can infer that the correct message consists of those 3 points in your set that form a line. A subtlety presents itself. How do you know there's only one way of choosing such a set of 3 points? It helps if we give our points names. Call them A, B, C, and D. If A, B, and C all lie in a line, then A, B, and C must be the set of points your correspondent meant to send. But what if A, C, and D also lie along a line? No worries, this is impossible, because the line containing A, B, and C and the line containing A, C, and D would then have the 2 points A and C in common. But 2 lines can only intersect in 1 point. That's the rule. In other words, thanks to the axioms of geometry, the Hamming code has the same magical error-correcting property as repeat 3 times. If a message gets modified by a single bit en route, the receiver can always figure out what message the transmitter meant to send. But instead of multiplying your transmission time by 3, your new improved code sends just 7 bits for every 3 bits of your original message, a more efficient ratio of 2.33. The discovery of error-correcting codes, both Hamming's first codes and the more powerful ones that came later, transformed the engineering of information. The goal no longer had to be building systems so heavily shielded and double-checked that no error could ever arise. After Hamming and Shannon, it sufficed to make errors rare enough that the flexibility of the error-correcting code could counteract whatever noise got through. Error-correcting codes are now found wherever data needs to be communicated quickly and reliably. The Mars orbiter Mariner 9 sent pictures of the Martian surface back to Earth using one such code, the Hadamard code. Compact disks are encoded with the Reed-Solomon code, which is why you can scratch them and they still sound perfect. Listeners born after, say, 1990 who are unfamiliar with compact disks can just think of flash drives, which use, among other things, the similar Bose-Chaudhry-Hockingham codes to avoid data corruption. Your bank's routing number is encoded using a simple code called a checksum. This one is not quite an error-correcting code, but merely an error-detecting code, like the repeat-each-bit-twice protocol. If you type one digit wrong, the computer executing the transfer may not be able to puzzle out what number you actually meant, but it can at least figure out something's wrong and avoid sending your money to the wrong bank. It's not clear whether Hamming understood the full range of applications of his new technique, but his bosses at Bell certainly had some idea, as Hamming found out when he tried to publish his work. He later remembered, "The patent department would not release the thing until they had patent coverage. I didn't believe that they could patent a bunch of mathematical formulas. I said they couldn't. They said, watch us. They were right. And since then, I have known that I have a very weak understanding of patent laws because regularly, things that you shouldn't be able to patent, it's outrageous, you can patent." Math moves faster than the patent office. The Swiss mathematician and physicist Marcel Golay learned about Hamming's ideas from Shannon and developed many new codes of his own, not knowing that Hamming himself had worked out many of the same codes behind the patent curtain. Golay published first, leading to a confusion about credit that persists to the present day. As for the patent, Bell got it, but lost the right to charge for the license as part of an antitrust settlement in 1956. What makes the Hamming code work? To understand this, you have to come at it from the other direction, asking, what would make it fail? Remember, the bete noire of an error-correcting code is a block of digits that's simultaneously close to 2 different code words. A recipient presented with the offending string of bits would be flummoxed, having no principled way to determine which of the near-miss code words appeared in the original transmission. It sounds like we're using a metaphor here. Blocks of binary digits don't have locations. So what can we mean by saying one is close to another? One of Hamming's great conceptual contributions was to insist that this wasn't merely a metaphor, or didn't have to be. He introduced a new notion of distance, now called the Hamming distance, which was adapted to the new mathematics of information just as the distance Euclid and Pythagoras understood was adapted to the geometry of the plane. Hamming's definition was simple. The distance between two blocks is the number of bits you need to alter in order to change one block into the other. So the distance between the code words 0010111 and 0101011 is 4. In order to get from the former code word to the latter, you have to change the bits in the second, third, fourth, and fifth places. Hamming's 8 code words are a good code because no block of 7 bits is within Hamming distance 1 of 2 different code words. If it were, the 2 code words would be within Hamming distance 2 of each other. But you can check for yourself and see that no 2 of those code words differ in just 2 places. In fact, any 2 different code words are at a Hamming distance of at least 4 from each other. You can think of the code words as something like electrons in a box or antisocial people in an elevator. They've got a confined space to live in, and within those constraints, they try to make as much mutual distance from each other as they possibly can. The same principle underlies all manner of communications that are robust to noise. Natural language works this way. If I write language instead of language, you can figure out what it was I meant to say because there's no other word in English that's one letter substitution away from language. This breaks down, of course, when you start looking at shorter words. A dog, a cog, a bog, and a log are all perfectly good things to which one might refer in English, and a burst of noise wiping out the first phoneme makes it impossible to tell which one was meant. Even in this case, though, you can use the semantic distance between those words to help you correct errors. If it bit you, it was probably a dog. If you fell off it, it was probably a log, and so on. You can make language more efficient, but when you do, you hit the same hard trade-off Shannon discovered. Many people of a nerdy and/or mathematical persuasion, not the same thing, by the way, have labored to create languages that would convey information compactly and precisely, without any of the redundancy, synonymy, and ambiguity that languages like English indulge themselves in. Rho was an artificial language created in 1906 by the Reverend Edward Powell Foster, who aimed to replace the thicket of English vocabulary with a lexicon in which the meaning of each word could be derived logically from its sound. It's perhaps no surprise that among the Rho enthusiasts was Melville Dewey, whose Dewey Decimal System imposed on the stacks of the public library a similarly rigid organization. Rho is indeed admirably compact. Lots of long English words, like ingredient, come out much shorter in Rho, where you just say shegab. But the compactness comes at a cost. You lose the error correction English offers as a built-in feature. Small elevator, very crowded, the passengers don't have much personal space. Which is to say, each word in Rho is very close to lots of others, creating opportunities for confusion. The word for color in Rho is bofob, but if you change one letter to make it bogob, you have the word for sound. Bokob means electricity and bolob means flavor. Worse still, the logical structure of Rho leads similar sounding words to have similar meanings too, making it impossible to figure out what's going on from context. Bofosh, bofof, bofog, and bofol mean red, yellow, green, and blue, respectively. It makes a certain kind of sense to have conceptual similarity represented in sound, but it also makes it very difficult to talk about color in Rho at a crowded party. I'm sorry, was that bofosh or bofog? Some modern constructed languages, on the other hand, go the other way, making explicit use of the principles Hamming and Shannon laid out. Lojban, one of the most successful contemporary examples, has a strict rule that no two of the basic roots, or gizmu, are allowed to be too phonetically close. Hamming's notion of distance follows Fano's philosophy. A quantity that quacks like distance has the right to behave like distance. But why stop there? The set of points at distance less than or equal to one from a given central point has a name in Euclidean geometry. It is called a circle, or, if we are in higher dimensions, a sphere. So we're compelled to call the set of strings at Hamming distance at most one from a code word a Hamming sphere with the code word at the center. For a code to be an error-correcting code, no string, no point, if we're to take this geometric analogy seriously, can be within distance one of two different code words. In other words, we ask that no two of the Hamming spheres centered at the code words share any points. So the problem of constructing error-correcting codes has the same structure as a classical geometric problem, that of sphere packing. How do we fit a bunch of equal-sized spheres as tightly as possible into a small space in such a way that no two spheres overlap? More succinctly, how many oranges can you stuff into a box? The sphere packing problem is a lot older than error-correcting codes. It goes back to the astronomer Johannes Kepler, who wrote a short booklet in 1611 called Strana Seu de Nive Sexangula, or The Six-Cornered Snowflake. Despite the rather specific title, Kepler's book contemplates the general question of the origin of natural form. Why do snowflakes in the chambers of honeycombs form hexagons, while the seed chambers of an apple are more apt to come in fives? Most relevantly for us right now, why do the seeds of pomegranates tend to have 12 flat sides? Here's Kepler's explanation. The pomegranate wants to fit as many seeds as possible inside its skin. In other words, it is carrying out a sphere packing problem. If we believe nature does as good a job as can be done, then these spheres ought to be arranged in the densest possible fashion. Kepler argued that the tightest possible packing was obtained as follows. Start with a flat layer of seeds, arranged in a regular pattern where each seed touches six seeds arrayed around it in a regular hexagon. The next layer is going to look just the same as this one, but cunningly placed so that each seed sits in the little triangular divot formed by three seeds below it. Then just keep adding more layers in the same way. It's best to be a little careful here. Only half the divots are going to support spheres in the next layer up, and at each stage, you have a choice of which half of the divots you want to fill. The most customary choice, called the face-centered cubic lattice, has the nice property that every layer has the spheres placed directly over the spheres three layers below. According to Kepler, there is no denser way to pack spheres in space. And in the face-centered cubic lattice, each sphere touches exactly 12 others. As the pomegranate seeds grew, Kepler reasoned, each one would press against its 12 neighbors, flattening its surface near the point of contact and producing the 12-sided figures he observed. Whether Kepler was right about pomegranates, I have no idea. But his claim that the face-centered cubic lattice was the densest possible sphere packing became a topic of intense mathematical interest for centuries. Kepler offered no proof of his statement. Apparently, it just seemed right to him that the face-centered cubic lattice couldn't be beat. Generations of grocers, who stack oranges in a face-centered cubic configuration without any worry as to whether their method is the absolute best possible, agree with him. Mathematicians, that demanding tribe, wanted absolute confirmation. And not just about circles and spheres. Once you're in the realm of pure mathematics, nothing stops you from going beyond circles and spheres to yet higher dimensions, packing the so-called hyperspheres of dimension greater than 3. Does the geometric story of high-dimensional sphere packings give insight into the theory of error-correcting codes, as the geometric story of the projective plane did? In this case, the flow has mostly been in the other direction. The insights from coding theory have instigated progress in sphere packings. John Leach, in the 1960s, used one of Golay's codes to build an incredibly dense packing of 24-dimensional spheres in a configuration now known as the Leach lattice. It's a crowded place, the Leach lattice, where each of the 24-dimensional spheres touches 196,560 of its neighbors. We still don't know whether it's the tightest possible 24-dimensional packing, but in 2003, Henry Cohn and Abhinav Kumar proved that if a denser lattice exists, it beats Leach by a factor of at most 1 plus twice 10 to the negative 30th power. In other words, close enough. You can be forgiven for not caring about 24-dimensional spheres and how to smush them together, but here's the thing. Any mathematical object as startling as the Leach lattice is bound to be important. It turned out that the leech lattice was very rich in symmetries of a truly exotic kind. The master group theorist, John Conway, upon encountering the lattice in 1968, worked out all its symmetries in a 12-hour spree of computation on a single giant roll of paper. These symmetries ended up forming some of the final pieces of the general theory of finite symmetry groups that preoccupied algebraists for much of the 20th century. As for good old three-dimensional oranges, it turns out Kepler was right that his packing was the best possible, but that wasn't proved for almost 400 years, finally falling in 1998 to Thomas Hales, then a professor at the University of Michigan. Hales settled the matter by means of a difficult and delicate argument that reduced the problem to an analysis of a mere few thousand configurations of spheres, which he dealt with by means of a massive computer calculation. The difficult and delicate argument posed no problem for the math community. We're used to those, and this part of Hales's work was quickly judged and found correct. The massive computer calculation, on the other hand, was trickier. A proof can be checked down to the last detail, but a computer program is a different sort of thing. In principle, a human can check every line of code, but even having done so, how can you be sure the code ran correctly? Mathematicians have almost universally accepted Hales's proof, but Hales himself seems to have been stung by the initial discomfort with the proof's reliance on computation. Since the resolution of the Kepler conjecture, he's moved away from the geometry that made him famous and turned instead to the project of formal verification of proofs. Hales envisions, and is working to create, a future mathematics that looks very different from our own. In his view, mathematical proofs, whether computer-aided or carried out by humans with pencils, have gotten so complicated and interdependent that we can no longer reasonably have full confidence in their correctness. The classification of finite simple groups, the now completed program of which Conway's analysis of the leech lattice formed a crucial part, is distributed over hundreds of papers by hundreds of authors, totaling some 10,000 pages. No human alive can be said to understand it all. So how can we be sure it's really right? Hales thinks we have no choice but to start over again, rebuilding the vast corpus of mathematical knowledge within a formal structure that can be verified by machine. If the code that checks the formal proofs is itself checkable, and this, Hales convincingly argues, is a feasible goal, then we can free ourselves forevermore from controversies like the one Hales endured over whether a proof is really a proof. And from there, the next step, maybe, is computers that can construct proofs or even have ideas without any human intervention at all. If this actually happens, is mathematics over? Of course, if machines overtake and then surpass humans in all mental dimensions, using us as slaves or livestock or playthings, as some of the most extravagant futurists predict, then yeah, math is over along with everything else. But short of that, I think mathematics will probably survive. After all, math has already been computer-aided for decades. Many calculations that once would have counted as research are now considered no more creative or praiseworthy than adding a series of 10-digit numbers. Once your laptop can do it, it's not mathematics anymore. But this hasn't put mathematicians out of work. We've managed to stay just ahead of the ever-increasing sphere of computer dominance, like action heroes outracing a fireball. And if machine intelligences of the future can take over from us much of the work we know as research now, we'll reclassify that research as computation, and whatever we quantitatively minded humans are doing with our newly freed up time, that's what we'll call mathematics. The Hamming code is pretty good, but one might hope to do better still. After all, there's something wasteful about Hamming's code. Even in the days of punched tape and mechanical relays, computers were reliable enough that almost all 7-bit blocks would come through unscathed. The code seems too conservative. Surely we could get away with adding fewer failsafe bits to our message. And so we can. That's what Shannon's famous theorem proves. For example, if errors come at a rate of 1 per 1,000 bits, Shannon tells you there are codes that make each message only 1.2% longer than its unencoded form. And better yet, by making the basic blocks longer and longer, you can find codes that achieve this speed and satisfy any desired degree of reliability, however strict. How did Shannon construct these excellent codes? Well, here's the thing. He didn't. When you encounter an intricate construction like Hamming's, you're naturally inclined to think an error-correcting code is a very special thing, designed and engineered and tweaked and retweaked until every pair of code words has been gingerly nudged apart without any other pair being forced together. Shannon's genius was to see that this vision was totally wrong. Error-correcting codes are the opposite of special. What Shannon proved, and once he understood what to prove, it was really not so hard, was that almost all sets of code words exhibited the error-correcting property. In other words, a completely random code with no design at all was extremely likely to be an error-correcting code. This was a startling development, to say the least. Imagine you were tasked with building a hovercraft. Would your first approach be to throw a bunch of engine parts and rubber tubing on the ground at random, figuring the result would probably float? Hamming, still impressed 40 years later, said of Shannon's proof in 1986, "Courage is one of the things that Shannon had supremely. You have only to think of his major theorem. He wants to create a method of coding, but he doesn't know what to do, so he makes a random code. Then he is stuck, and then he asks the impossible question, what would the average random code do? He then proves that the average code is arbitrarily good, and that therefore there must be at least one good code. Who but a man of infinite courage could have dared to think those thoughts? That is the characteristic of great scientists. They have courage. They will go forward under incredible circumstances. They think and continue to think. If a random code was very likely to be an error-correcting code, what's the point of hamming? Why not just choose code words completely at random, secure in the knowledge that Shannon's theorem makes it very likely your code corrects errors? Here's one problem with that plan. It's not enough for a code to be able to correct errors in principle. It has to be practical. If one of Shannon's codes uses blocks of size 50, then the number of code words is the number of 0-1 strings 50 bits long, which is 2 to the 50th power, a little over a quadrillion. Big number. Your spacecraft receives a signal which is supposed to be one of these quadrillion code words, or at least close to one. But which one? If you have to flip through the quadrillion code words one by one, you're in big trouble. It's the combinatorial explosion again, and in this context, it forces on us another trade-off. Codes that have a lot of structure, like the Hamming codes, tend to be easy to decode. But these very special codes, it turns out, are usually not as efficient as the completely random ones that Shannon studied. And in the decades between then and now, mathematicians have tried to ride that conceptual boundary between structure and randomness, laboring to construct codes random enough to be fast, but structured enough to be decodable. The Hamming code is great for the Transylvanian lottery, but not so effective at cash windfall. The Transylvanian lottery has just 7 numbers. Massachusetts offered 46. We're gonna need a bigger code. The best one I could find for the purpose was discovered by R.H.F. Denniston of the University of Leicester in 1976, and it's a beauty. Denniston wrote down a list of 285,384 six-number combinations from a choice of 48 numbers. The list starts like this. 1248348, 2348459, 1248 3632. The first 2 tickets have 4 numbers in common, 2, 3, 4, and 48. But, and here is the miracle of the Denniston system, you will never find any 2 of those 285,384 tickets that have 5 numbers in common. You can translate the Denniston system into a code, much as we did with the Fano plane. Replace each ticket with a string of 48 ones and zeros, with a 0 in the places corresponding to the numbers on your ticket, and a 1 in the places corresponding to the numbers not on your ticket. The fact that no 2 tickets agree on 5 out of 6 numbers means that this code, like the Hamming code, has no 2 code words separated by a Hamming distance of less than 4. Another way to say this is that every 5-number combination appears on at most 1 of Denniston's tickets. And it gets better. In fact, every 5-number combination appears on exactly 1 ticket. In math terms, this is because Denniston's list of tickets forms what's called a Steiner system. As you can imagine, a lot of care is required in choosing the tickets on Denniston's list. Denniston includes in his paper a computer program in Algol that verifies that his list really does have the magical property he claims, a rather advanced gesture for the 1970s. Still, he insists that the computer's role in the collaboration is to be understood as strictly subordinate to his own, writing, I should like, indeed, to make it clear that all the results announced here were found without recourse to computers, even though I suggest the computers may be used to verify them. Cash Windfall has only 46 numbers, so to play it Denniston style, you have to destroy the beautiful symmetry a bit by throwing out all the tickets in Denniston's system containing a 47 or a 48. This still leaves you with 217,833 tickets. Suppose you get together $435,666 out of the couch cushions and decide to play these numbers. What happens? The lottery draws six numbers, say 4, 7, 10, 11, 34, 46. In the unlikely event these match one of your tickets exactly, you win the jackpot. But even if not, you're still in line to win a healthy pile of money for matching five of the six numbers. Do you have a ticket with 4, 7, 10, 11, 34 on it? One of Denniston's tickets does. So the only way you can miss out is if the Denniston ticket with those five numbers was 4, 7, 10, 11, 34, 47, or 4, 7, 10, 11, 34, 48, and thus got trashed. But what about a different five-number combination, like 4, 7, 10, 11, 46? Maybe you had bad luck the first time because 4, 7, 10, 11, 34, 47 was one of Denniston's tickets. But then 4, 7, 10, 11, 46, 47 cannot be on Denniston's list because it would agree in five places with a ticket you already know to be there. In other words, if Evil 47 makes you miss out on one 5 out of 6 prize, it can't make you miss out on any others. The same goes for 48. So of the six possible five-number wins, you are guaranteed to have at least four of them among your tickets. In fact, if you buy the 217,833 Denniston tickets, you have a 2% chance of hitting the jackpot, a 72% chance of winning six of the five out of six prizes, a 24% chance of winning five of the five out of six prizes, and a 2% chance of winning four of the five out of six prizes. Compare this with the Selby quick pick strategy of choosing tickets randomly. In that case, there's a small chance, 0.3%, of getting shut out of the 5 out of 6 prize tier entirely. Worse, there's a 2% chance of getting just one of those prizes, a 6% chance of getting two, an 11% chance of getting three, and a 15% chance of getting four. The guaranteed returns of the Denniston strategy are replaced by risk. Naturally, that risk comes with an upside, too. Team Selby has a 32% chance of getting more than six of those prizes. Impossible if you pick your tickets according to Denniston. The expected value of Selby's tickets is the same as that of Denniston's or anyone else's, but the Denniston method shields the player from the winds of chance. In order to play the lottery without risk, it's not enough to play hundreds of thousands of tickets. You have to play the right hundreds of thousands of tickets. Is this strategy the reason Random Strategies spent the time to fill out hundreds of thousands of tickets by hand? Were they using Denniston's system, developed in the spirit of utterly pure mathematics, to siphon money from the lottery at no risk to themselves? Here's where my reporting hit a wall. I was able to get in touch with Yuron Liu, but he didn't know exactly how those tickets had been chosen. He told me only that they had a go-to guy in the dorm who handled all such algorithmic matters. I can't be sure whether the go-to guy used the Denniston system or something like it, but if he didn't, I think he probably should have. Okay, fine. You can play Powerball. At this point, we've documented exhaustively how the choice to play the lottery is almost always a poor one in terms of expected number of dollars, and how, even in those rare cases where the expected monetary value of a lottery ticket exceeds its cost, great care is required in order to squeeze as much expected utility as possible out of the tickets you buy. This leaves mathematically minded economists with one inconvenient fact to explain, the same one that baffled Adam Smith more than 200 years ago. Lotteries are very, very popular. The lottery is not the kind of situation Ellsberg studied, in which people face decisions against unknown and unknowable odds. The minuscule chance of winning the lottery is posted for all to see. The principle that people tend to make choices that more or less maximize their utility is a pillar of economics, and does an adequate job modeling behavior in everything from business practice to romantic choices. But not Powerball. This kind of irrational behavior is as unacceptable to a certain species of economist as the irrational magnitude of the hypotenuse was to the Pythagoreans. It doesn't fit their model of what can be, and yet it is. Economists are more flexible than Pythagoreans. Rather than angrily drowning the bearers of bad news, they adjust their models to fit reality. One popular account was offered by our old buddies Milton Friedman and Leonard Savage, who proposed that lottery players follow a squiggly utility curve, reflecting that people think about wealth in terms of classes, not numerical amounts. If you're a middle-class worker who spends $5 a week in the lottery and you lose, that choice costs you a little money but doesn't change your class position. Despite the loss of money, the negative utility is pretty close to zero. But if you win, well, that moves you into a different stratum of society. You can think of this as the deathbed model. On your deathbed, will you care that you died with a little less money because you played the lottery? Probably not at all. Will you care that you retired at 35 and spent the rest of your life snorkeling off Cabo because you hit the Powerball? Yes. Yes, you will. In a bigger departure from classical theory, Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky suggested that people in general tend to follow a different path from the one the utility curve demands, not just when Daniel Ellsberg sticks an urn in front of them, but in the general course of life. Their prospect theory, for which Kahneman later won the Nobel Prize, is now seen as the founding document of behavioral economics, which aims to model with the greatest possible fidelity the way people do act, not the way that, according to an abstract notion of rationality, they should. In the Kahneman-Tversky theory, people tend to place more weight on low-probability events than a person obedient to the von Neumann-Morgenstern axioms would, so the allure of the jackpot exceeds what a strict expected utility calculation would license. But the simplest explanation doesn't require much theoretical heavy lifting at all. Simply, buying a lottery ticket, whether you win or not, is, in some small way, fun. Not Caribbean vacation fun, not all-night dance party fun, but $1 or $2 worth of fun? Quite possibly so. There are reasons to doubt this explanation. For instance, lottery players themselves tend to cite the prospect of winning as their primary reason for playing, but it does an admirable job of explaining the behavior we see. Economics isn't like physics, and utility isn't like energy. It is not conserved, and an interaction between two beings can leave both with more utility than they started with. This is the sunny free marketeer's view of the lottery. It's not a regressive tax. It's a game where people pay the state a small fee for a few minutes of entertainment the state can provide very cheaply, and the proceeds keep the libraries open and the streetlights on. Just as when two countries trade with each other, both parties to the transaction come out ahead. So yes, play Powerball, if Powerball is fun for you. Math gives you permission. There are problems with this view, to be sure. Here's Pascal again, delivering a typically morose take on the excitement of gambling. This man spends his life without weariness in playing every day for a small stake. Give him each morning the money he can win each day on condition he does not play, you make him miserable. It will perhaps be said that he seeks the amusement of play and not the winnings. Make him then play for nothing. He will not become excited over it and will feel bored. It is then not the amusement alone that he seeks. A languid and passionless amusement will weary him. He must get excited over it and deceive himself by the fancy that he will be happy to win what he would not have as a gift on condition of not playing. Pascal sees the pleasures of gambling as contemptible, and enjoyed to excess, they can, of course, be harmful. The reasoning that endorses lotteries also suggests that methamphetamine dealers and their clients enjoy a similar win-win relationship. Say what you want about meth, you can't deny it is broadly and sincerely enjoyed. But what about another comparison? Instead of strung-out tweakers, think about small business owners, the pride of America. Opening a store or selling a service isn't the same thing as buying a lottery ticket. You have some measure of control over your success. But the two enterprises have something in common. For most people, opening a business is a bad bet. It doesn't matter how delicious you believe your barbecue sauce to be, how disruptively innovative you expect your app to be, how ruthless and borderline felonious you intend your business practices to be, you are much more likely to fail than to succeed. That's the nature of entrepreneurship. You balance a very, very small probability of making a fortune against a modest probability of eking out a living against a substantially larger probability of losing your pile. And for a large proportion of potential entrepreneurs, when you crunch the numbers, the expected financial value, like that of a lottery ticket, is less than zero. Typical entrepreneurs, like typical lottery customers, overrate their chance of success. Even businesses that survive typically make their proprietors less money than they'd